This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Last month, sitting on my front porch, I watched as a young woman and a little boy walked down the street. The boy spotted a blooming plant. It was a rhododendron with bright pink flowers. He reached up for his companion's hand and drew her down for a closer look. They were half a block away, but I imagined they spoke of the beauty of the blossoms. This afternoon, we'll contemplate the draw of flowers, the role they play in our lives. Our guest is nature writer Charmin Apt Russell. She is the author of Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers. Listeners, I look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. Questions are welcome. So too are your stories about flowers. Join us with a telephone call. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. In addition to Anatomy of a Rose, Charmin Apt Russell is the author of When the Land Was Young, Kill the Cowboy, and Songs of the Flute Player. Her writing has also been featured in a number of anthologies and magazines. She teaches writing at Western New Mexico University and Antioch University in Los Angeles. Her book, Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers, is now available in a paperback edition from Perseus Publishing. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Charmin Apt Russell, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon.
Flowers have really quite a pull on us. In that little story that I told, it was, well, a literal pull.
Yes, yes. And you know, we give them away, and with that subtext always of somehow I love you, on graduation day, on funerals, you know, at times of joy, times of sorrow, to sick people, to people celebrating something. They're really interwoven in our cultural life.
Mm. Tell us, if you would, about the flowers your grandmother would place on the graves of family members.
Well, I spent the summers in the Midwest, although I you know, lived in Phoenix. So I was kind of a city girl going to the country. And like many people, a flower garden was a practical thing that you had as well as your vegetable garden. And it was practical because you used flowers and, you know, you took them to church, you took them to weddings, you took them to anniversaries, you took them places. And my grandmother took them to the grave of her son, which was my father. He died when I was two. So you know, you took them constantly to the cemetery as a way of continuing your relationship with the people you love. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I went with her. And
yeah.
Always remember cutting the flowers, arranging them, you know, the association they had with my father.
Yeah. What's your first memory of flowers?
Well, that would have to be it, you know,
uh-huh.
I think the snapdragons that she used to, you know, because they were, you know, you could open them up, you could play with them as a child, you could kind of, you know, open and close the snapdragon. So I think that was pretty primal for me, that being
yeah.
in the garden surrounded by all those colors, and then using them as part of my relationship with someone who was important to me.
Mm-hmm. I remember marveling at lilies as a little girl.
Yes.
And how they were so, the scent was so heady.
Yes.
And they were so dramatic, and then the pollen, if you put your nose close.
Yes. You had a yellow nose.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think flowers, I think we respond to them on two really important levels. And one is that physical, you know, we respond to the color, you know, that kind of pure white or that startling red. And I think that's biological. You know, the rainforest is all green and the desert's all brown, and it's color that kind of screams out something to us as animals, either kind of look at me or warning. And we respond to the scent, I think, in that physical level too. But I think, of course, we have wrapped them up in our stories, in our metaphors, in what they represent to us as well.
Mm.
So,
there's a beautiful little story or poem. Maybe it would be more accurate to call it a poem that incorporates the, I think it is a Native American story.
Uh-huh.
The path of pollen.
Oh, right. The pollen path.
The pollen path,
the
yes.
The pollen path for the Navajo. Yes, and we walk the pollen path. And then, you know, once you realize that flowering plants are totally what we depend on, all, you know, that's what animals eat, that's what we eat as well as eat animals, that humans are completely dependent on flowering plants. it kind of adds another dimension to walking the pollen path.
Yeah, flowers are essential.
Yeah, they're essential. And you know, they're about, they're about sex. You know, we all know they're the reproductive organ of the flower, of the plant. But I think, you know, we kind of sometimes think of sex as recreational, but really it's about continuity. It's about the world going on. It's about the next generation and kind of the things that we give up, you know, that we do for the next generation. So what they represent is so primal, too, I think.
Mm. Are there many plants that do not flower?
There aren't many. I mean, there are many in number because they're called the gymnosperms, and there's the conifers, and there's some ginkgo trees, and there's some cycads. So if you're looking at a pine forest, you're going to see a lot of things that aren't flowering plants. But most species in the world now are flowering plants.
Mm. You said earlier we love flowers because we love color.
Yes.
It turns out, though, we're only seeing part of the show.
I know. That's what really attracted me in part is not only did I want to figure out why flowers made me so happy, what was my emotional connection to them, but I realized that they just had this whole secret life that had nothing to do with me. Most pollinators see ultraviolet, and so flowers are really a totally different color from what we see as often as not. They're either, you know, they're either in ultraviolet or they're mixed ultraviolet with blue. They have patterns in ultraviolet. So a honeybee zooming into the meadow sees a completely different world than what we see.
Yeah. In general terms, can you tell us what is known about how insect pollinators see flowers?
Well, because they see ultraviolet, you know, they'll see a white flower, a white daisy, and actually it may be, radiating ultraviolet, which they see. And we don't really know what color that is. That's what's so kind of extraordinary about it. We can see when it's there by using fluorescent lights, but we just don't have the chemistry to see it. So they'll see green as more gray. They're not interested in the green. They're interested in zooming in on that color. And they'll see kind of a range of colors that we don't see. And then also, as we all know, flowers have patterns. They have these kind of nectar guides. And most of them are in colors that we do see, you know, blue or red or orange. But some of them are in ultraviolet. And, of course, the honeybee sees those as well.
Yeah. Flowers change color. And, you know, I hadn't thought about this until I read your book. But, you know, we notice that there is the bud.
Mm-hmm.
And then we know there is the flower.
Right.
And then we notice the blossom fades.
Yeah.
But there's a very practical thing going on here.
Right. And as, you know, especially in a bush or what we call an inflorescence with many flowers on the same plant, once they're pollinated, the flower doesn't really want the insect doesn't want to come back and try and drink from an empty flower. And the flower wants the insect to go to other flowers on its bush or on its inflorescence. So it changes color as a signal to the pollinator that it's done, I'm fertilized, go elsewhere, but stay with me. And of course, it wants to keep some color or some shape to attract the pollinator from a distance. So there's so many strategies going on all the time between the plant and between the insect so that they both get what they want.
Yeah, and the pollinators are so diverse.
Yes, yeah, it's, you know, we, the kind of engine of pollination is in some ways the bees, but certainly beetles and you know, cockroaches and ants, and in Africa there's a giraffe that pollinates a certain flower. You know, anything that works, that's what the natural world is all about, the diversity of things that work.
A neighbor of mine has a wonderful plant that it lives indoors in the wintertime, and then she brings it outside in the summertime, and it blooms at night in September.
Yeah.
It's from the tropics.
Right.
And
she
grew it from a cutting.
Right.
And it is spectacular.
Yes. Some of those plants that open at night, I know here where I live, the desert plants would be the cereus cactus or these night blossoming. And they're pollinated often by moths. And I think they have to be they're often white. I don't know if this one is. They often have to be quite showy for the moth to see. It's twilight. It's a little dim. And they often smell very strongly because moths are attracted to the flower mainly through the smell. And they're extraordinary, you know. And I think they seem special to us because we're not nocturnal. So when we see something happening at night, we really know it's outside our normal world.
Yeah. Well, this is a plant. It's from the tropics. Uh-huh. And it's pollinated by bats.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
The blossoms are white and big as dinner plates.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't know the common name, but, you know, that's extraordinary. Did she have bats come? Or
no. No. And I asked her, I said, have you tried pollinating it by hand?
Yeah.
And she said no.
No. You know, bats send out a call, and the flower kind of responds to that call by kind of turning so that the call kind of bounces back. So there are these intricate kind of, you know, interplays between bats and the flowers they pollinate.
Huh. And the flower has a big musky scent.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's also was interesting to me, just the range of scents. And again, that world in which, you know, we just think of flowers for us because we use them so much and we use the ones that are beautifully colored and that smell, you know, wonderful to us. But a lot of plants, of course, smell like rotting meat, or they smell like fungus, or they smell musky, you know, to attract a bat. They smell like rotting fruit. That would be, you know, a bat would want to come feed on
fruit.
Some nice rotting fruit. And so it would want a flower that kind of smells like that, too.
Yeah. And the other thing that is so dramatic about this plant is that the show is so brief.
Yeah.
I mean, even briefer, we all know that a flower, generally most flowers, don't have a long life.
Right.
But this flower just lasts.
Right.
You know, I think you could see it, you could stand there and be comfortable and watch it open
slowly
and fade.
And fade, yes. Well, you know, a number of them do that, although the plant itself, and that's kind of in our minds, that's a distinction we have to remember. The flower fades, and then maybe a new blossom is forming for the next night. I know in our area we have a similar cactus that has a beautiful white flower that only comes maybe four nights a year and only stays open a few nights. But the cactus itself lives for 75 years. So it has every summer to keep trying again, you know, to get pollinated.
Yeah. So. You write about that plant in the book.
Uh-huh.
I was delighted to read that because I had this experience with a night-blooming plant.
Uh-huh.
And,
yes.
And I think in the book you said that at the time you wrote that essay for the book, you hadn't seen it.
No, I hadn't, and I haven't still. And that's okay. You know how you kind of like to have a dream or a pursuit you haven't done yet?
Uh-huh.
I know people have them, and I know I could do it. I almost like to keep it as this kind of mythic symbol that, you know, one of those things I'll accomplish sometime when my kids are grown or something.
Yeah. The only thing, flowers are, you know, it you want to. I mean, there's something wonderful about being in awe of them.
Yes. Yeah. They're for me, they're like, you know, they're the non-human, totally non-human, and they're kind of like the beloved, you know, the thing that's not you. They're so involved in their world, and it's not the human world. And I think I personally do like to be in awe of the non-human world.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of a plant and its flowers, you know, going back to this night-blooming plant that my neighbor has, you know, and the time that flower is in bloom is so short.
Right.
You know, in one of the discussions of the serious cactus, you know, you ask, what's the plant's point of view here?
Right.
And, you know, you said, well, in the case of the serious cactus, it's got 75 years.
The cactus does, right.
Yeah. But also, it's a lot of work for a plant to produce a flower.
It is. You know, it's that the materials of reproduction, you know, when you think of sperm and pollen and you know, ovaries, I mean, eggs, they're all really quite fragile, and you have to protect them a lot. You have to protect them from heat and from wind and you know, from the elements. So you really want to get fertilized as soon as you can and to start the process of producing your seed and starting the next generation.
We're talking about flowers this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is nature writer Sharman Abt Russell. She's the author of Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers. Listeners, I look forward to hearing from you. Won't you join us with a telephone call? Your questions are welcome. So to your stories about flowers, what's your earliest memory of flowers? Here are the numbers to join us. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area where it would be a toll call, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Some flowers are only scented. Let's continue here to talk about scent.
Yeah.
Are only scented at night, some only in daylight.
Right. And some are most strongly scented for just a few hours of that daytime. They kind of open at noon, say, and really give their best during a few hours, and then they kind of close. You know, you think of 4 o'clocks because they kind of open around 4. And they're kind of timed with their pollinators so that their pollinators, they know when their pollinators will come at a certain time and when it's advantageous to look there and smell their best for their suitors, I guess.
Yeah. Some flowers produce heat.
Yeah, that was a really wonderful, surprise to look at this whole group of flowers that can generate heat. And one of them is the philodendron, and it's our common houseplant. I mean, I think many of us have seen them around. A houseplant won't produce a flower, but in the native, in Brazil, they come from Brazil and other areas like that, they produce this kind of rod that can generate up to 115 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's doing that to volatilize its oil so that all the beetles will be even more attracted. And they come, and they kind of live in the flower for a little bit, and they mate, and they feed on the pollen, and then they get well dusted with pollen.
Yeah, I guess it's like a beetle cruise.
Yeah.
Off to the tropics we go.
right. From warm, safe place, now let's go to another, maybe bar hopping is another way of doing it. Because they move from philodendron to philodendron, and of course as they move, they take the pollen with them.
Are there many such flowers?
There aren't many, but there's the voodoo lily, and there's the sacred lotus. It's evolved in more than one family. There's the skunk cabbage, which you might have in your area, I don't know. And so there's not a lot, but there's enough so that you can see it's an evolutionary technique. It's a strategy that a few plants have chosen.
Mm. Well, how long have flowers been around?
Well, the earliest fossil we have is 120 million years old. And it's about the size of a period, and it just has the female flowers on it. So it's not the full flower as we know it, but 10 million years later, by 110 million years ago, we do have flowers that have male and female, and they're starting to have other parts like carpels and where you can really see them responding to insects and how an insect would kind of manipulate a flower. And then by 90 million years ago in New Jersey, they found hardened fossils that, resemble carnations or azaleas or rhododendrons. So once it started happening, it happened fast, it looks like.
Hmm. A listener is waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Vermilion County. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've been wondering for quite some time, when one sees hummingbirds or bees visiting flowers, and sometimes in bees particularly, they just back immediately right back out again.
Right.
If a given flower has had its nectar supped,
I
guess.
That's what it is.
Does that individual flower make more nectar, or is it gone for the season?
Well, some flowers make more nectar and some don't. So the Latana flowers around here, once the butterflies come and sucked up the nectar, it's gone. And so that flower turns a different color to kind of signal to the pollinator, don't try me. But other flowers keep producing more nectar. And so, so the bee, of course, might also be smelling it's kind of lured by the odor of pollen because it's collecting pollen too. And so it'll back out if it senses that there's not enough pollen there.
Well, in order to prove that, what kind of an experiment would you set up?
Well, I tell you, scientists, this is what scientists sit around and do. And, you know, it's kind of fun. First of all, they set up flowers and then they watch them. They might take a Latana bush, and they actually use little paper wicks to wick out the nectar from them. And then they maybe sometimes even paint the colors of a flower to mimic how it might have changed. And then they watch what the bees do and the pollinators do. They also perform a little more gruesome experiment sometimes in which they have insect in the lab, and they might cut off its antenna so that it can't smell and see what it does then. So it's really quite a range, and it's kind of the human mind trying to get exactly the piece of information at once. And you kind of hit exactly on how kind of fascinating but also hard it is.
So in an individual flower, once that nectar is gone physically, would they then test for sugars the next day inside that flower?
Right, certainly. They could dissect the flower and see if it has nectar in it. And, of course, they can also sometimes, you know, well, again, you know, a flower would probably try and signal the pollinator if it could. Or it might just stop trying to attract pollinators at all and get busy with the act of, you know, producing the seed.
Uh-huh.
But there is an important thing to remember is the range of what flowers do. Some flowers do this, some flowers do the opposite. You know, it's an incredible diversity, and they're very flexible in terms of how they've evolved to deal with specific circumstances.
Mm-hmm. In this climate, we often plant lantanas as an
lantana?
Annual. Yes. To attract the butterflies.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned they change color when they've been...
They do. If you look at, you know, those little flowers they have are kind of a range of sometimes pink and orange and yellow,
mm-hmm.
and they change those colors to signal their pollinator. They do that in the wild. Now, I don't know what kind of, you know, now that we've begun breeding flowers, we breed some of their evolutionary strategies out of them, sometimes purposefully and sometimes just by accident.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Sharman Apt Russell, our guest this afternoon. She's the author of Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers. Flowers, our topic this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. How have we affected the evolution of flowers,
right. Well, you know, we have quite a bit in the sense that we brought flowers from around the world, and so we've moved them around a lot, and that means they evolve, you know, differently in a new spot. We certainly have bred flowers for thousands of years. You know,
mm-hmm.
the Chinese started, you know, crossbreeding and domesticating flowers a long, long time ago. And so we've changed their shape. We usually like them to be bigger. We like them to be hardier. We like them to have different colors than they might naturally have. So we do that. Of course, now we're talking about bioengineering. We're talking about taking a gene, finding the gene for the color blue, and putting it in a rose
mm-hmm.
so that we could have a blue rose. And we're talking about finding the gene for citrus, the smell of citrus, the smell of lemon, and also putting in the rose. So we'd have a blue rose that smells like a lemon. You know, now we've kind of reached a new level of the kinds of ways we can change flowers.
What do you think about that, a blue rose that smells like lemon?
Yeah, you know, in the book, I think I'm very, very clearly ambivalent.
Mm-hmm.
I admire and respect what we do as human beings. We're so curious, and of course, I admire and respect science. And a lot of this is going to be used for crops, technologies, having whole crops maybe bloom at the same time, which will be easier. And so we have a lot of people to feed. There are a lot of good intentions. Aesthetically, a blue rose kind of appalls me. I'm drawn more to wildflowers anyway, And so when the cultivated flower gets too human, you know, I guess it goes back to what I love about flowers is that they're not human.
Mm.
And when it gets too humanized, too much kind of a artifact, like something I could buy at a store, it just appeals to me less.
Yeah. What's the oldest living flower?
Oh, yes, the oldest living flower. It's a amberella, I think, and it's kind of, by oldest living flower, it means it's the, you know, it's the flower that looks most like the original flower. And I think it was found on some little island, you know, one of those things that mm-hmm. that we wouldn't expect. And it's the other one, there's a lily, too, that's quite old. One of the things that's interesting, though, is that that keeps changing. They keep kind of coming up with new flowers or using DNA techniques to look at new relationships between flowers
uh-huh.
that we couldn't even see before because we didn't have the DNA technique.
Yeah. And the classification of flowers is changing.
Yes, the classification. And of course, that's a touchy subject for people who classify, because I know if I classify something, I'd like it to be forever, but but it isn't. You know, it people reclassify again based on what they've suddenly discovered in terms of DNA or in terms of you know, other techniques. And then some people are just tired of the whole classification and they want something that's simpler and easier to use.
Mm.
We all kind of get a little annoyed at the Latin sometimes.
Yeah, it's tough unless you've been educated in that.
It is, and you can understand the reason. You know that there are mm-hmm. literally thousands and thousands of species of daisies, and you can't just say daisy, and you can't just say oxeye daisy, because even that may not be specific enough. But really, the Latin seems cold at first, and you love the common names because they're more evocative.
Mm. Now, have you learned the Latin names of flowers?
Well, I put it in short-term memory. And I have a whole category of things in short-term memory that eventually fade if I don't use them all the time. And, you know, I'm working now on a related book about butterflies. So now I have all kinds of things, you know, Latin ideas about butterflies that I think are starting to replace the flowers,
mm-hmm.
pushing them out somehow.
What have you got growing in your garden?
Well, I have, you know, yarrow and roses and coreopsis and daisies and just tons of stuff. We are, as you might have heard in the news, you know, in the middle of a drought. That's in the area where all the fires are raging. We haven't had a drop of rain all year long. It's June, and we haven't had no measurable precipitation. So it's kind of sad to go out into the natural world, and there are no flowers, really, or very few. I know our first generations of butterflies and other pollinators have probably starved to death because we didn't have those flowers for them. So what's left for them really are, you know, the hollyhocks and the abundance of flowers that people grow in their yards.
Hmm. I wonder if you've grown anything in particular, given your interest now in butterflies and working on a butterfly project.
Yeah, we have something called the butterfly bush, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there are a whole list of flowers that attract butterflies. I have to say that I'm something of a voyeur in that I go around and enjoy other people's yards. and I delight when they're very ambitious. But and I looking out at my yard now, and I am seeing, you know, the hollyhocks and the hummingbirds, and I do see flowers. It's a lot of work.
It is.
Of course. So I'm always encouraging my neighbors to plant more flowers so that I can enjoy them.
Yeah. Is there any one flower that when you first saw it, you said, this is the most amazing flower I've ever seen?
Yeah, you know, a couple examples come to mind. In my own personal life, I guess it would be the sacred datura, the Jimson weed. Every time I see it, it's you know, kind of bowls me over. It's one of, again, those kind of blooms around twilight. It's pollinated by moths. And so it's white, and it kind of seems to glow, and it's got this long tube that the sphinx moth sticks its proboscis in. And it's also got it's big, and it's also hallucinogenic. It's kind of a dangerous flower. Every once in a while, kids try it out because they've heard it, and it can cause serious damage. So it's got that danger, sinister side to it. It looks a little sinister as well as looking very beautiful.
Yeah. Well, if it crops up on your property, it can be a real problem.
Yeah, you know, it was on our property. Right now, I'm living in town, but I was living in the country, and I did have, you know, little kids, and it was a problem because just to eat it casually is not a good idea. So I think we removed it, or we removed the flowers.
Mm. Well, we've talked a little bit about color and scent this afternoon.
Yeah.
We haven't talked a lot about shape.
No, that's true. And, you know, again, the shape kind of is all for the pollinator. So, you know, you have shapes that are kind of circles that are kind of democratic flowers because kind of any insect can land on them and walk around and get to the center. They're easy to manipulate. And then you have things like orchids or delphiniums or flowers that have really specific shapes for, you know, for a hummingbird to insert and to get out the nectar, or for, in the case of an orchid, for a bee to kind of land on the lip, and sometimes they even fall in and they have to exit out a certain trapdoor. So then you get these very complicated shapes that either manipulate insects sometimes or are designed to make it easier for insects.
Yeah. Such diversity.
I know. You could just talk about flowers a long time because there's so many kinds, and they've evolved so many nasty tricks as well as, you know, good things.
Yeah, you write about a flower that if the pollinator goes into the female flower.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
Or vice versa. I can't remember now.
It's the jack in the pulpit, and there are many other flowers kind of like that, or at least some others, that the jack in the pulpit will either be male or it will either be female. And it emits the odor of fresh fungi, which smells really good to a gnat. And the gnat comes and it flies to the flower and it kind of tumbles into its chamber. And flowers that have chambers often have means of kind of keeping the insects there by bristles or by kind of oil-coated surfaces that kind of keep the insect there. So if it's a male flower, then that flower wants the gnat to escape because it's disseminating its pollen and it wants the gnat to go out and take the pollen somewhere. But if it's a female flower, the jack in the pulpit doesn't really care what happens to the gnat, and so it doesn't provide it with an escape route. It's got the gnat's pollen, and it's being fertilized, and so the gnats usually die.
Mm.
It can, you know, it can be brutal. It's a brutal world with flowers.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
We use flowers to tell one another we love one another.
Yes.
or to remember someone.
Right, we do.
To present as a gift.
Yes.
To people. We also use flowers medicinally.
We do. We have, of course, a very long tradition as tribal people in using flowers and in using flowering plants. And we know that, you know, that yuccas have compounds in them that are steroids, and mulleins have compounds that are sedatives, and yarrow can clot blood. I mean, we have, and that oaks are, you know, astringents. I mean, we have very detailed information about flowers, you know, our people who still live close to the natural world do. And now, of course, we use them in our prescription drugs as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think a quarter of our prescription drugs have some part or synthesis of a flowering plant.
And research has got to be continuing to roll on in terms of discovering other capabilities for flowers.
It is. And as much as it's continuing on, it's one of the main points that environmentalists make about, you know, why save the rainforest or why protect diversity, because I guess we've really only studied about 1% of plant species in the world, and we're constantly coming up with things that plants might be able to do. It's a long process from seeing that a plant has, you know, compounds that reduce your white blood cell count to coming up with a drug that you can put on the market, but we know of so many plants that do these extraordinary things, and there's so many plants we haven't even looked at and explored, that's a very practical reason environmentalists say to protect, you know, to protect our species,
yeah,
our various species of plants.
And species of plants are disappearing.
Yeah, you know, I think it surprised me. I knew that things were bad, but when you start going to botanical congresses, and I'm sure it's true of zoological, anything with the natural world, it's like going to a funeral. You know, there's just this kind of dirge-like quality because they really, scientists really feel, you know, one-third to two-thirds of species might go in the next 100 years. And that's, they call it the seventh extinction, the extinction of you know, the dinosaurs was the last one, 65 million years ago. So we really are going through something very major and powerful. And, of course, scientists want to go out and study a plant. Sometimes a graduate student will study some particular plant on a remote island, and then within 3 years, they can't find it anymore. I mean, things are disappearing literally before their eyes, because they're looking at places where the extinction is happening so rapidly.
Yeah, and I think it's hard for us to understand that because we look around and, you know,
there's so much there, and I think we even see more diversity because, you know, if you live in a hot place, you see plants from Brazil and all over, and if you live in a cold place, you see plants from China. You know, in our yards and in our landscaping and in our suburbs, we see an incredible diversity of plants now because we've moved them around.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, you know, I'm reminded now of what you call Hawaii, the extinction capital of the world. And,
right.
You know, I would think maybe if I was going to have to call Hawaii the capital of something, I might have called it the capital of flowers.
The capital of beauty. And
yes.
Exactly. And of course, it's not, you know. Now, its extinctions have a lot to do with animals because once we brought in domestic animals, they really killed up. Islands are particularly vulnerable. You know, an island may never have known a pig. And then when that pig comes in, it can be very powerful. But, you know, once you start knocking off one part of the system, once you start knocking off some mammals or some birds, then you start knocking off plants, too, because the birds may have been part of pollinating the plant. And then, of course, once you start doing any kind of agriculture or farming, you can knock off, you know, you're just literally pulling out the plants. They may need a lot of them. They may need to be a mass of plants in order to keep pollinating each other, in order to keep their genetic diversity survive, and you just end up killing, you know, getting rid of so many of them that the whole population can't survive.
Yeah.
That's what we did with the passenger pigeon. It just couldn't survive unless it was in a big group. So places like Hawaii, islands, and tropical areas like rainforest are the most vulnerable.
Mm. Should be careful where we tread and how we tread.
Yeah. There are ways, as I say, you can start feeling kind of mournful. This, I think anyone who works in the natural sciences can go down that sense of you know, sorrow and loss. You know, on the other hand, I think people love flowers. I think our emotional attachment to them is going to save a lot of flowers and is going to maybe, you know, it's the hope in all of this. We do care about the plants around us. We can't imagine living in a world that isn't surrounded by that kind of growth and greenness. I mean, think how many of us are gardeners or just cherish our houseplant or cherish our memories of flowers.
Mm. How long have people been giving one another flowers?
Well, you know, I did learn that, you know, the Neanderthals buried people with kind of versions of hyacinth and knapweed. And those may have been, we don't know what was going on. That was 50,000 years ago. They may have been medicinal flowers. They may have been part of a shaman's toolkit. We have no way of knowing. But the fact that we start pretty early on seeing flowers associated with death is, it's part of giving it. You know, we give flowers to our dead, to the people we care about. And in terms of, you know, associating flowers, I mean, we look at the Greek myths. They were, you know, they were constantly turning people into flowers, you know, young men into a narcissus or to a hyacinth. And so flowers have been mixed up in religion for a very, very long time. The Egyptians, the Hindus, the Greeks, they were very much, the Aztecs, very much caught up in what flowers symbolized spiritually.
Mm. So we've been on the pollen path forever.
Yeah. There's a wonderful essay by Lauren Isley that that connects the age of mammals with the age of flowers, and that just as mammals really started diversifying and evolving our eventually into us, flowers were also doing the same thing. We kind of entwined in this burst of creativity and diversity. So we have always had a strong connection with flowers.
Hmm. For folks listening this afternoon who may find themselves thinking, boy, this is pretty interesting. and they would like to know more about flowers and the history of flowers and myths about flowers and so forth and so on. Where would you suggest they start?
Well, I always go to First Church. there are some wonderful books written about kind of the mythology of flowers. The titles don't spring right to mind, but I have an extensive bibliography in my book, and so almost anything I bring up, I mention where I got it from.
Yeah.
And, the other thing I would suggest is that almost all states have a native plant society.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an exciting way to learn about the local flowers that evolved in your climate, in your place, in your ecosystem. As well as, of course, all the garden clubs that deal with, our domesticated flowers. I think they're both exciting. As I say, I'm a voyeur in other people's yards as well as in my own, so I can't imagine not planting new flowers every year. But I am particularly drawn to the wildflowers in my area, too.
Mm-hmm. What's it like for you to go to the garden center?
In Los Angeles, I mentioned garden centers.
Yeah.
Well, and here, too, we have a wonderful nursery here. It's kind of you're kind of in shock if you respond a lot to flowers and you're suddenly surrounded by, 20 different kind of roses and all those flowers. Sometimes I have the same sense when I'm in a bookstore.
Yeah.
It's too much.
Yeah. It's like trying to take in an art museum in an afternoon.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of an overload. And sometimes, the world is just so beautiful, you don't know how to respond to it. You don't feel kind of up to the beauty of it, and other times you do.
Mm. Well, you write beautifully about it.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
We're out of time, and I'm sorry to say that, because it's just been a pleasure talking with you
afternoon. Thank you. I've enjoyed it, too.
Charmin Apt Russell has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. If you're interested in flowers, look for her book, Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers. It's now available in a paperback edition from Perseus Publishing.